Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is artist and activist Mary Fisher. She spent a lifetime giving voice to the voiceless, and tonight we're talking about her new book, Uneasy Silence, An Activist Seeks Justice and Courage Over a Lifetime of Change. Mary, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I'm so glad that you reached out to us and wanted to do this.
What I was really impressed by is not only is it a really soul-searching memoir, but it's also a nice collection of your art.
Thank you.
Now, this is your third book or your third memoir?
It's my third memoir.
This is more than a memoir. I mean, there is certainly aspects of memoir in it, but you really ask yourself some really hard questions, and you're also asking it of the readers. What really sort of prompted you to write this book at this time?
Well, Mark, I think it's what happens when you get a little bit older, and then you start to think, I don't know, why am I still here, and what can I do to help others, and all of that. And after COVID, I think COVID, really, I was so isolated, and I was so frightened about dying that way, all by myself. And who knew how COVID would affect my body? I had no idea. And since I've had it twice now, but now there's medication and things like that. I think that part of it was about that. And the other part of it is I just don't really care what people think of me. I think it's important to speak out. I don't know. I mean,
We're very close in age, Mary. So
okay.
I know
what I'm saying.
Oh, I know exactly what you're talking about. But this COVID thing, you almost, you had a really horrible incident with fentanyl during COVID.
I did. I know. It wasn't like I was taking fentanyl. It was one of my eyes. I had cataract surgery, and they overdosed me.
Oh, my God.
And I know. It was, well, and then I was still alive. But, I mean, I ended up in the emergency room of the hospital, and I thought that L.A. had been like a terrorist attack or something, because everybody, there was screaming and yelling, and it was an emergency room. And so there was so much going on, and I had no idea that it happened.
Oh, my God. I
can tell you, it's like I didn't even know I was sent there in an ambulance, and I got very upset because all of those ambulance people and those first responders are so adorable, and I didn't get to meet any of them.
You write that one of the worst things for you during COVID was the loss of community. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, I found I needed to find a community in L.A. because I got stuck in L.A. When COVID came. And the reason I did was because my son's wife was pregnant and she was having a baby. And why I'm still here, but maybe to be a grandmother, I'm not sure. But that was why I was here. And I really didn't have a community built up here, except for my family. And they were my bubble during COVID. So that was not a bad thing. But I didn't have so much community as I usually did when I was living in other places that I had lived for a while. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. And I think that was true. I think a lot of people felt that. So many of the artists that I know are still doing projects that were inspired or caused by their experiences during COVID.
Yeah, that's true. I can agree with that very much.
Now, reading this book, Uneasy Silence, I really personally got the feeling that you've literally walked through the furnace. And for people who are not old enough to remember, and I do remember this, you were an HIV positive woman that spoke at the Republican convention back during the Reagan years.
No, not Reagan.
Not Reagan.
Not that far, 92. It was George Bush, 41.
Okay, right after that. And that was a huge moment. That was unbelievable when you did that.
Yes.
How did you get the gumption and the nerve to do that?
Well, I think the gumption and the nerve to do that came after the gumption and the nerve to go public.
Yeah.
Because when I decided that it was important for me to speak out, I have two small children. I mean, toddlers, and thought I don't want them to grow up with the stigma, the discrimination, the hatred, really. And I thought at that time that I only had like 4 or 5 years to live. So I was like, okay, I don't mind going public. I'm not going to lose my job or my insurance and things like that, that maybe I can, I don't know, make a difference. But I had dear friends who said to me, we've been waiting for someone like you, so get out there. And I'm going like, no. And actually, I can tell you a quick story about Betty Ford.
Yeah.
Want to hear?
Yeah, sure.
So after I was diagnosed, before I went public, I took the children to see the president and Mrs. Ford because they were also godparents to my children. And I wanted them to see they were fine and I was fine and all of that. So after Betty, you know, and I spent some time crying and doing all the things that you do when you're grieving and not understanding, she said to me, okay, now what are you going to do?
Huh.
And what do you mean? She said, how are you going to help other women and men and people? I said, I think I'm going to die soon, so I don't know that I have that ability. But, you know, she was like, no. You have to think more about this, and I'm going to help you think more about this. And she was the one that really pushed me to say, you know what, this is what you do. I mean, she had done it.
Right. That's absolutely right.
For her, you know, her alcoholism, yep, her breast cancer. And I still love her, but I mean, I loved her outspokenness. I loved her ability to reach people. And she was like, I said, but I'm not Magic Johnson, you know, and he had come, you know, because he also was diagnosed, or else he went public in 1991 and I was diagnosed in 91. And I go, but I'm not anybody, you know, I'm just a mother and an artist. And
but that's the important, I think that's more effective than Magic Johnson.
Well, no. I mean, maybe in some respects and in some audiences. So therefore that audience.
Yeah.
Truly.
What?
Because I do sometimes wear 3 strands of pearls and things.
And I'm sure you wear them well.
Don't do this anymore. Okay.
But Mary, one of the things that I find sort of scary is so many people today have no memory of those years, of the AIDS years, the plague years. They just have no idea that it went on. They don't know the details of it. I was doing this show still back then. I lost many friends. I lost friends who were in the station with me. And
I'm so sorry.
If you were, especially if you're associated with an arts community, everybody lost people.
Right.
But what do you do about the fact that it's literally erased from many people's minds right now?
Well, that's one of the other reasons that I thought the book would be important.
Mm.
Because it is, I mean, I think it is up to us, because so many people have died, that it is up to those of us who are still here to make sure that young people don't misunderstand what this disease is and actually tell the story of what happened and how it happened and how we lost communities and friends and family and people. I mean, just right and left. It was awful. And no matter what you did, you know, it was like there wasn't any help at that time.
As you write in the book, I think it was 3 years before Reagan even mentioned the word AIDS.
Right.
I mean, the government was no help at that time.
No, and that was before, I think that was before me anyway, but no, he didn't. But Elizabeth Glazer, you know, she pushed him. She pushed him pretty well. And she had the community, she had the, you know, the California community, and she was doing pediatric aides, and people could be, they could be upset about children, you know?
Yeah.
It really was a matter of letting people understand. First of all, I used to go to the schools in the early days, in the 90s, and speak at the schools and talk to, I wasn't a person who did 101, like a banana, and show them what a condom was, but I would talk to them about drinking or drugs or whatever, because once you do that, you kind of lose your, you lose your inhibition, and you might make bad decisions. This is not a decision where you can get a shot and it's gone.
That's right.
This is your life. And I watched as time went on how school boards didn't want me talking anymore. You know, they just didn't want to hear about it. And yet the young people really did want to hear about it because they, you know, they were experimenting. And so I think that in those days it was just, those are the kind of stories that you need to tell now so that young people understand that.
Now, Uneasy Silence is a very personal book, and you wrestle in writing with a lot of core issues that all of us confront, and you write a lot about the power of words. Is there any power in silence?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think silence is complicity. Silence is just walking away.
But could that be a reasonable choice for somebody?
Well, it could be a reasonable choice in certain in certain situations, of course, Mark. I mean, yes, certainly. But if you have the ability to speak out and use your voice and people listen to you or have conversations with friends or just in your community or your schools, you have that ability, whatever it is. It doesn't have to just be about AIDS or anything. It could be whatever you're feeling about politics or whatever you're feeling about the way the world is or how do we help others. I mean, I was so torn by thinking that we as a really, I mean, wealthy country can't feed our children.
Oh.
And that's
a big part of this book is food insecurity and food shortages.
Food insecurity and poverty. And, you know, it was just, which helped create for me another community, a group that Project Angel Food is a group that I had always known about and had been part of in many ways, but I wasn't living here. So when I could go to the kitchen and volunteer, and then, you know, I became involved and got involved with many of the people there, and I realized this is my family, this is my community, and I'm very happy in this community to be doing for those who are how do I say this, that can't get food, that we do medically tailored meals to the to people with whatever disease it is that they have. It started just with HIV. It started in like 1989. So it was just taking care of people with HIV, but now it's all kinds of diabetes and cancer and people that are home, you know, they can't get out. And that's what Project Angel Food does. So for me, I feel like, you know, we can make a difference. We don't have to do everything, Mark, but we can do something.
Well, you write about that too, that lacking a sense of purpose and meaning in people's lives, that seems to be symptomatic of many people. And they can feel it. They can feel a lack of sense of purpose and meaning. How do you get over that? How do you just start something and get into it?
Well, I think first you decide, you know, what is it that you would love to make a difference in? What kind of an organization? Children, schools, food, like you're talking about, like trying to help people get food banks, whatever, and then just go volunteer. Just volunteering even once a week or once a month will change your life, because it gives you a sense of purpose, and it makes you understand where we are in our world. And you also create a community by doing that with the people that are also doing it with you.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is artist and activist Mary Fisher. She spent a lifetime giving voice to the voiceless, and we're talking about her new book. It's a memoir, Uneasy Silence, An Activist Seeks Justice and Courage Over a Lifetime of Change. Mary, also important in your book is income disparity, and it sort of seems like the food insecurity is a subset of income disparity.
Absolutely. I don't know what to even say about that. It's not right. And I think that that's part of our problems now. And, you know, sometimes you just have to go small, start small, and find out what your purpose is and what makes you feel like you know, serving others is what I try to do all the time, because it not only helps others, but I do believe that it feeds my heart. And yes, I think that, you know, the generations of wealth and stuff like that it's difficult. It's very difficult. People don't understand a lot of that.
It's gotten worse over the decades. I mean, it was bad before, but it seems to have gotten really putrefying now.
Oh, you don't even want to get into that with
me. Okay, sorry. You know what? Let's talk about your art.
Okay, that's a good idea.
Now, this book is profusely illustrated with your art throughout this book. Talk to me about the materials that you're using.
I am so excited about this book because it is also a book of art, and each chapter has a different picture that leads into it. And what I can explain to you is that the pieces that look like figures, it's handmade paper. Huh. And it's handmade paper that I put over backgrounds that I did with watercolor. And someone who knows how to work a computer better than me helped me figure out that we could make it look 3D, because it is 3D. All of those pieces are 3D. They're handmade paper, and they're people. And it is, to me, like my help in giving back to people. Or I think of all the people and friends that I've lost, and I've done a lot of art about that, without naming names, but just that we, you know, we've lost so many people in our world, and maybe not for a good reason.
The figures are really interesting because they're also fairly abstract. They somewhat remind me of Giacometti figures.
Oh, thank you. Oh, I like that. Thank you.
But talk to me about...
I love Giacometti. Yeah.
You have a sparing use of color, though. Talk to me about your use of color and what you feel about color.
Well, I love color. But when you're working with handmade paper, you have to be careful of the color, because it doesn't always work the way you think it's going to work. Because when it dries, it dries lighter. And so I think the backgrounds have more color probably than each of the figures.
Yeah.
They should stand out anyway.
But there's a couple of figures that do have a little daubs of color in different ways. But
right.
And then when you see that, it really stands out. It's really dramatic.
Oh, well, thank you.
What's the size? Good. What's the actual size of the pieces?
Well, these pieces, some of them are a foot tall. Some
wow.
of them are 6 feet tall.
What?
Some of them are
Whoa. Mary, back up. Did you say 6 feet tall?
I have some pieces that are 6 feet tall. Not in the book, but I made figures that tall.
Wow.
And some of them are, you know, just 4 inches tall.
Yep.
Mostly... It's just working with handmade paper that I had been doing this for quite a while, and it's my way of, you know, I guess giving back. I don't know. I love doing it. So
do it. Well, let me talk to you about your history of art, your evolution. What kind of art did you start out doing and when?
When I was in seventh grade.
Okay. That's fair enough.
And this is, well, it was. I did. I started as a weaving at my school in Michigan. And I loved weaving. Weaving was a place that I could go when things were not going well at home or anywhere. I could go into the studio at school and weave. And that was how I started, with textures and fabrics and fibers. And that's always lived with me.
Have you always have you always been figurative?
No, not always figurative. No. I've been just about everything. I don't know how to explain that, but you know, in 1985, I know I talk about it a little bit in the book, but when I was living in Washington, I was doing a 1995, sorry. I was living in Washington, and I had been asked to do I can't even think of the word, an exhibition at the Senate Rotunda.
Wow.
And I said, okay, great. And at that time, I was doing podiums, because I speak from a podium. So I was making podiums. I'm using my hands a lot and you can't see me, but I was making screens that would tell a story about AIDS and about children or about Africa and the orphans and all of that kind of stuff. And it would tell a story about AIDS. And the crowning piece of this was that I made a coffin and I put handmade paper flowers on top of it, but it was all decorated on the sides. I wouldn't say decorated, but written and painted and everything to say that we should maybe talk about this in life rather than in death. And everything was on the truck to go down to the rotunda on a Friday to get set up. And one of the senators called me and said that they're canceling it because you can't have a coffin without a body in it. And I said, well, that's ridiculous.
That is ridiculous.
I mean, and I thought, I'll find a body. I could do that. No, Mary. You know, I thought maybe I could do something. But they hadn't seen it. And I think I know which senator it was in those days. But, one from North Carolina.
Okay. Jesse? Okay.
And they hadn't really looked at it, even though I had sent pictures of everything. So I went to a friend of mine and Ted Kennedy, and they got me into the Carpenters Union, which is right across from the Capitol.
Yeah.
And I got to still have the exhibition there. It wasn't not as many people probably saw it, but I did get to do a lot of media, and that was good. So, but they were afraid. They were really afraid.
That's amazing. And they hadn't even seen the work. They hadn't seen the work.
Not in person. They'd only seen pictures.
This current work that's in Uneasy Silence, it really struck me because depending upon my mood or what was going on, they look very dynamic, like an image that's melting in the rain. So they look like people in states of flux, maybe decaying, maybe building up. It depends upon what you're thinking about it. I found them really interesting. And texturally, there's a definite texture to them. And that was really fascinating.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Because that's great. I love hearing that because it means that you're actually, you know, it gave you a feeling.
Yeah, it does.
And that's important. Yeah.
And it's really interesting reading the text and then looking at the work. I thought that was a great juxtaposition. Did you do that in your earlier books?
Not as much, no. I did do a book of art, but mostly my first few books, I did pictures of my children. And, you know, I probably not as much art.
These are really...
Now's the time.
Well, I think you should be doing a series of these with your art. And it doesn't have to be the same kind of art. I mean, your art obviously has evolved through the decades. because yes. we all change, and your obviously your artwork is going to change too.
Exactly. Well, thank you for that. I'll let you know, Mark, if it comes of that.
Well, you're going to exhibit them?
No, I did have an exhibit, but that was years ago of many of these people that were hanging, but probably not now, not anymore.
Well, I hope people get this book because it's a fascinating and meaningful text combined with some fascinating art. And that's not something you see commonly at all.
Well, I'm really grateful for you saying all of that. Thank you so much, Mark, really.
Well, all I did was look at it. You wrote it and made the work. You did the heavy lifting in this, Mary.
You read it. You really read it. And that makes me feel like, you know, making a difference. And that's why I'm here.
Well, we're completely out of time, and I strongly recommend this book. My guest tonight has been artist and activist, Mary Fisher. And she's really spent a lifetime giving voice to the voiceless and working in several organizations traveling the world. And we've been talking about her new book, Uneasy Silence, An Activist Seeks Justice and Courage Over a Lifetime of Change. Mary, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, Mark. I agree. It's been a pleasure for me as well.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.